Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Earlier this month, we had a conversation with Susan Hockfield for our monthly Marine Biological Laboratory's Falmouth Forum Lecture Series. It was so interesting, we decided to invite her back to cover some areas we didn't get to. She's President Emerita and Professor of Neuroscience at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and the first woman and first life scientist to lead MIT. Her new book is The Age of Living Machines, How Biology Will Build the Next Technology Revolution. It just won the 2020 Science Communication Award from the American Institute of Physics. Great to have you back.
Mindy, it's great to be back in conversation with you too.
So remind us again, what are living machines?
Living machines is a term I've developed for this thing, but one of the important thing to recognize is what living machines are about, in my mind, is technologies that are built using biological parts. Those parts are not living when they're working, but they were built by living organisms. So, for example, some of the technologies that I describe in the book use proteins that are made and used by living organisms, but used for that purpose in a different environment. For example, each of our cells has to control the flow of water into and out of the cell. That water flow is controlled by a pore. That's a protein. And that pore is called aquaporin, only passes water into and out of the cell. There's a company called Aquaporin that has produced a huge amount of these aquaporin proteins and is building those proteins into commercial water filters. So that's an example of what I would call a living machine, a technology that using as its component parts, not physical things that built by, our standard physical processes, but things that are built by living organisms.
In our previous discussion, we talked about some amazing discoveries, virus-built batteries, protein-based water filters, as you're talking, and cancer-detecting nanoparticles. A couple of things we didn't get to, and we'll start with the mind-reading bionic limbs. I can't help but think of the TV show The Bionic Man. Jim Ewing had a rock climbing accident, and while he survived, he faced a difficult decision. Should he keep or give up his natural leg that was causing him great pain and a lack of function? And that set him off on a journey that you talk about in the book.
Yeah, I mean, one can imagine the difficulty of trying to decide whether you continue with a limb that isn't serving you the way you need it or make the gamble on going to a prosthetic device. And of course, if you look throughout human history, people have devised all kinds of ways of making up for a missing limb. We've gotten better at it, but really not quite as good as we need to be. And one of the problems with most prostheses, that's an artificial limb, a prosthetic device, is that while they can serve as kind of a gap filler, right, that connects, for example, your knee to your prosthetic foot, these prosthetic devices don't really communicate with the way we communicate with our feet. And the way you and I would communicate with our feet, do communicate with our feet, is through connections between that foot and our brain. And it's very complicated and really quite wonderful the way our brain animates our limbs, our legs and feet, and also the way we receive signals back from our legs and feet so we know what they're doing. So one of the very interesting frontiers of prosthetic development today is giving more lifelike function and lifelike sensation to a prosthetic leg and foot. And I have to say, these are technologies that would have been impossible without the kind of computational facilities that we have today. And frankly, would not be possible if we didn't understand as well as we do how a living organism, how a living dynamic leg and foot operate. So all of that knowledge is being built into these new kinds of prosthetic devices in quite amazing ways. So in the book, I do tell the story of Jim Ewing, and one of the most exciting things is having him climb a cliff face, and actually it's the cliff face from which he fell and subsequently had to give up his leg. But climbing that with a new kind of prosthetic leg and foot that allows him to actually feel the cliff beneath his prosthetic foot.
That's amazing. Now, you visited one of the companies doing pioneering work on a prosthesis in Iceland. Tell us about that visit.
Oh, that was an amazing visit. A visit to Össur, which is a company that is devoted to prosthetic limbs and has been around for a very, very long time. And so has been part of the development of these devices. And there were so many things about the visit that just changed the way I think about prosthetic devices. You know, I closed the chapter with something that at the beginning of my visit seemed odd and at the end of my visit seemed obvious, which is that the ladies' room, you know, we have these icons that tell us where the ladies' and men's rooms are, and they show a stick figure, but the stick figure always has two legs, right? And the Össur figure that represents the ladies' room shows a woman lady stick figure with one natural leg and one prosthetic leg. And I have to say, but by the end of my visit, I had adopted the point of view that these prosthetic devices are part of us. And people who wear prosthetic devices are like all of us. And that is the goal, to give full functionality back to people who have lost limbs in any number of ways. So it was an inspiring visit, both in the people I met, absolutely devoted to this problem, and in the way it changed my understanding of what it meant to not just develop these devices, but also to wear and use them. They're doing incredible things, and it's another example of ideas that emerge from research laboratories that, of course, emerge as a very, very cool possible idea. And then when to get to the marketplace, it has to go through a company that understands all the practicalities of building any complicated device, but doing it in an economically possible way, and also in a way that responds to not just the marketplace drivers, but also the individual users' idiosyncratic conditions and needs.
You know, it's interesting, too, when you see some of the folks using, like, say, these artificial legs and watching them walk, you could notice a limp or something. Some with some of the stuff they're using now, you wouldn't even know it, right? You wouldn't even know that they have an artificial limb.
No, exactly, Mindy. One of my hosts was walking me around. We spent the whole day, you know, climbing stairs and going at a pretty fast pace up and down the corridors. And, you know, I never thought anything of it. You know, and then we were in one of the test labs where they were demonstrating for me one of the new devices, the ankle and foot devices, and trying to explain to me the importance of having an active ankle, not a passive ankle, but an active ankle. Because when you and I climb stairs, we get a lot of help from the foot that pushes off from the bottom stairs, you know, and not just the foot that lands on the top. And, you know, I had never thought that this is a problem for most prosthetic devices. And this individual who was conducting the tour said, well, let me show you. And he rolled up his pants leg to reveal that he was wearing one of these devices. And I had no idea. I mean, the cadence of his walking was, you know, identical to what I would call a normal person. And indeed, he is a normal person. But he's a normal person wearing a prosthetic device.
And the work that they're doing gives great hope to people with spinal cord injuries. This is really amazing.
That is an entirely amazing area of development. I'm a neuroscientist by training, and so I'm pretty well versed in the complexity of understanding how the brain gives rise to the motor commands. So if I want to pick up my phone, I look at my phone, my hand moves and I pick it up, I don't think about it. But as a neuroscientist, I understand the complexity of that task. So for people who have spinal cord injuries of a variety of sorts, you know, in the most severe forms, at a level of the spinal cord where they lose the ability to control and sense all four of their limbs, you know, the problem in giving them some motility back, we have to understand what the brain is doing and figure out how to transmit the brain signals that tell me to pick up my phone to either a robotic arm or ultimately to animate my own now paralyzed arm. And this has been a quest for a number of researchers. And I visited a group in outside of Geneva that at times led by John Donahue, and they have designed with others ways of taking a very, very fine, small electrode with many, many sensors and placing that in the brain of people who are quadriplegic, that is, are paralyzed in all four of their limbs. And then through this multi-pronged electrode, reading out the brain signals that say, you know, reach out your arm and grab not a cell phone, but let's just say a cup of coffee. And then taking those signals that they read from the brain, those volitional signals, and transmitting them to a robotic arm. Absolutely, for me, you know, kind of a science fiction kind of story. And this technology is to the point where now those signals can be read out not to a robotic arm, but to the individual's own arm through another set of connections that send the signals to the muscles of the arm and direct that individual's arm to do the task that the brain is imagining, reach out and pick up a cup of coffee. I mean, as I say, it's quite remarkable, and I wouldn't say this is in its infancy. These developments are pretty far along and promise to provide to people who have been robbed of the standard facilities of living, being able to use your hands and arms, being able to speak, the possibility of restoring to them function by, absolutely critically, being able to read their intent simply by the signals that remain in the individual's brain, being able to mind read, as it were, and then translate that mind reading into action.
That's amazing. And you actually got to witness this, Kathy, a woman paralyzed from the neck down by a stroke. Tell us about that. You said this actually brought you to tears.
Yeah, this was is a video that this group made. And actually, the first the first person to actually perform with these devices at a level of they would consider success. So, a woman who's paralyzed from the neck down for a very long period of time, fitted out with one of these brain electrode sets, and she's asked to think about reaching out her arm to pick up a cup of coffee and bring it to her lips. And, of course, she has no motion on her own, but you can see her face as she works to think about moving her arm. And you see the robotic arm reaching out, grabbing this thermos of coffee, bringing it to her mouth. And it's just, it's excruciating because it's clearly such a labor, and navigating it so she can put the straw in her mouth and takes the first sip of a latte, the first sip of anything that she has said to herself since she became paralyzed. She then, takes a sip, she puts the cup down, and her face breaks into a smile. It actually makes me weep just remembering this extraordinary demonstration of not just incredible technology, but incredible human will.
It's amazing. And another really large problem we have, of course, is feeding the world. Dr. Jim Carrington is the president of the Danforth Center and a plant molecular biologist. And you're right, Carrington began our discussion by introducing the challenge of rapidly escalating our food productivity. If we expect to meet the world's needs anticipated in 2050 using today's methods and technologies on the farm, he said we would require additional farmland at least as large as the continents of Africa and South America combined. This is a big problem.
A stunning problem. I mean, he posed this problem in a way that, literally makes your jaw drop. Now, one of the things that I certainly didn't appreciate before I went on the adventure of writing this book is that we have been absolute geniuses in increasing productivity, crop productivity. And what that means is the amount of food you can get out of an acre of land. So over, I would say the last 100 years, crop productivity in the United States has skyrocketed. In the 1920s, early 20th century, we could produce about 50 bushels of corn an acre. Today, we produce upwards of 150 bushels of corn an acre. That is the reason that we do as well as we do today, although I would say we're still not good enough, but we do pretty darn well at feeding most of the world. And we do that because of these increases in crop productivity. And frankly, that has been part of the recipe for success going back hundreds of years. In the book, I talk about the Reverend Thomas Malthus, who wrote an essay on the principle of population in 1798. And he was sounding the warning, which we now know is the Malthusian dilemma. The Malthusian dilemma is that population rate, growth rate, is faster than the growth rate of crop productivity. That's a disaster. So you can compensate by a number of ways. One is you can just farm more land. But in, you know, around 1800 in Britain, there wasn't much more land to farm. Or by increasing the productivity of the land you're farming. And Malthus saw this coming and did a historical analysis and realized that every time population growth outstripped agricultural productivity growth, it ended in tears. Wars, famine, pestilence served to reduce the population back to a level that the resources could provide. So in 1798, he said, watch out, it's coming. But that time he was wrong. It was wrong because there were new technologies that would soon increase the productivity of farmland in Britain. And those new technologies were four-field crop rotation and, importantly, new sources of fertilizer that were discovered by the seafaring pioneers who were, as I read in my social studies book in, fourth grade, they were, sailing the world looking for jewels and gold and tobacco and spices and things like that. Well, sure, but they also came upon islands that had been inhabited only by birds forever, and those islands were essentially huge piles of bird guano, which is an excellent fertilizer. And there was a vibrant trade in bird guano in the 19th century, which really changed the game for farmers. In any case, my thesis is that these Malthusian dilemmas, which we face, and we face one today, what are we going to do? Population's growing from about 7.5 billion to almost 10 billion by 2050. How are we going to feed all these people? I make the assertion that we're going to figure it out. We can figure it out if we put our minds to it by innovating. We can innovate new technologies to continue the growth of agricultural productivity. We can produce more food from the land we have if we get very, very smart about how to do it. So that's kind of, the premise of the book is we face a Malthusian dilemma today, and we could just resign ourselves to the kind of war, pestilence, and famine that Malthus predicted in 1798, or we can use the tried and true method of inventing our way out of it. And I would say the problem, all of the problems that we face, I mean, we talk about water and food and healthcare and energy. I mean, obviously, a growing population has growing demands. And I think one thing that I think is very important for us all to keep in mind is that we should hope that the growing population of the world will also be a wealthier population. We might not say that so much for all of the population be wealthier, but certainly to bring people out of poverty is a critical part of achieving a better future than our present. And that means as people become come out of poverty, their demands also increase. They demand more energy. They demand more food. They demand more health care. And we've got to be able to provide for that.
Yeah. Talk about a cassava, a crop that we were seeing a lot in the developing world. I had never heard of it before I read your book. It grows, I guess, in poor soils, resists drought. Its roots are like tubers. This is an important crop, but it's had some problems.
Right. So you're talking about cassava. And, like you, I was not aware that cassava is among the world's most important staple crops for a number of very poor populations in the developing world. Now, cassava is a a very useful food crop. As you just said, it can grow in non-optimal conditions and provides a huge fraction of the food for much of the world's poorest people. Now, unfortunately, plants, like people, succumb to viruses. You know, as we are facing the COVID virus now, and you know, we're very concerned about how that virus is transmitted and how we can combat it. Cassava has a virus also, and that virus is moving very rapidly through the cassava crops all over the world, and threatens to basically ruin this crop, which would throw some of the most impoverished people into a state of starvation. Now, how do we combat these kinds of food viruses? And we combat them through science and engineering. And there's an international consortium that is devoted to combating the cassava virus. And they've been very successful. They have developed a strain of cassava that is resistant to the virus. Parenthetically, unbeknownst to most of us who just go to the grocery store and buy bananas or buy papaya, both of those crops were actually beset with a similar kind of virus, obviously not the same virus, because the same virus doesn't won't have the specificity to infect different crops, but there has been a banana virus and there was a papaya virus that was combated. Both of those were combated by the same kind of bioengineering, biotechnology that's been put in place for the cassava virus. However, bananas and papayas are money-producing crops, cassava not so much. Mm. So the people who wanted to combat the cassava virus needed to do it with a different kind of economic model and rely very, very heavily on philanthropic and government support. In any case, there is a strain of cassava that has been bred to be resistant to the virus. But then we move into, you know, out of the scientific challenge into the political challenge. The virus-resistant cassava is a genetically modified organism, as are the virus-resistant bananas and the virus-resistant papayas that we buy in the store now. And the deployment of this virus-resistant cassava in the developing world has been very aggressively blocked by those who are opposed to all genetically modified organisms. So there has been quite a fraught battle. Recently, the countries that want to deploy cassava have actually gotten ahead of this and have started to do the kind of test planting that is absolutely required to be sure that these new strains of cassava can withstand the conditions under which they will be grown, can produce cassava in a volume that will satisfy the needs and are, of course, safe. That the safety was established first. So there's been some progress, but just the story of, you know, between the scientific difficulties and then the political difficulties illustrate the complexity of moving forward in these dimensions.
Yeah. You know, we talk about genetically modified foods. I think people think of that as being something sort of new, right? But this, in reality, this has gone on quite much longer than most people realize.
Yeah, exactly, Mindy. We've been genetically modifying foods for thousands of years, long before we understood what genes were. We were moving around from plant to plant. It's what crossbreeding is about. You know, our ancient ancestors, you know, there was a real breakthrough in the ability to create civilizations when we became able to actually control the food we grow, finding the, you know, the best plants in the wild and hybridizing them to one another and developing crops that were dependable and, you know, easy to increase yield. So we've been doing this very cleverly for a long time, not just crops, but also animals. There's been a lot of interest recently in the development of dogs from wolves, a similar kind of crossbreeding of genetic manipulation has produced the dogs that we know today. So we have been moving genes from organism to organism for thousands of years. It's just now we know what genes are, and we can move those genes with higher selectivity and specificity than we could, than our ancestors could.
When we think about, you know, the technology and how far we have come in a relatively short time, I'm wondering about maybe if there's ethical questions here. You know, technology can be used for good or bad, right?
Absolutely, Mindy. So this is something that I think we all have to understand. Technology by itself is agnostic, and it's up to us to decide how we're going to use those technologies. And obviously, there are any number of examples of technologies that have been used for ill, either on purpose or accidentally. And we have to approach the use of technologies with the awareness that we don't know everything about them. And we have to proceed carefully, thoughtfully. But in my mind, we can't stop technology simply because we are afraid of all of the unknowns, but we have to have enough certainty about the unknowns that we can imagine to know that we are deploying these technologies to the good of people and not ill. But, you know, our human history is, you know, fraught with episodes of technologies that were developed for good, that were used for ill. I mean, I've read fascinating book called The Alchemy of Air, which is about, it's about fertilizer, about fertilizer. We need nitrogen to make our soils, you know, able to support the crops we need. And there was a tremendous push at the end of the 19th century to figure out how to get nitrogen out of air, how to trap that nitrogen from the air and put it into the soil as fertilizer. And that technology was developed quite brilliantly and against all odds. And was just at the point of active implementation when World War I broke out. And that nitrogen-fixing technology that was going to produce crops to feed the world instead was turned to the production of nitrogen for the prosecution of war. And it's, you know, it's just, it's a heartbreaking story, and I'm not sure it could have gone differently, but it is a profound example of technologies that were built for the good of humanity than being used to destroy humanity. So we can't know in advance all the possible uses, but I don't think that's a reason not to develop technologies. But we do need to understand as much as we can about the potential downsides of technology and guard against them.
We talked about the work of Sangeeta Bhatia the last time we met, but I want to revisit it because it's just truly mind-blowing. She's developed early cancer detection with a low-cost urine test, which is in clinical trials now. Tell us a little bit again about this.
Yeah, so this is a fascinating convergence 2.0 of biology plus engineering approach to disease and healthcare. So one of our difficulties in healthcare is detecting disease early enough to have an impact. Cancer is just one example, but cancer is a disease that starts with a single cell that's gone awry, and that one cell becomes two and becomes four, becomes eight, and you know, pretty soon you've got a lot of cells that are misbehaving. And for cancer, if you can detect a cancer at the very earliest stages, you have a better chance of curing it than if you detect it later when it's, you know, not just grown to a large cell mass, but, you know, perhaps even left its primary location and metastasized to a secondary location. So early detection is really important to control disease. And we have some great cancer detection technologies today, but they're still pretty late in the game. So Sangeeta Bhatia, who's a physician scientist, MD, PhD, she's a nanotechnologist, as well as a clinician, decided to try to use nature's genius and try to use the things that nature does well to amplify detection and move disease detection to make it more sensitive and earlier, therefore earlier. And what she does is she builds nanoparticles. And the nanoparticles are decorated with a kind of molecule called a protein. And those proteins are designed so that they can read out whether or not a disease is present. Let's go back to cancer as the example. One of the insidious ways that cancer attacks is by those cells not respecting normal bounds. your liver cells, your skin cells, they stay where they're supposed to be. They do what they're supposed to do. But a liver cancer cell or a skin cancer cell doesn't do that. It doesn't stay where it's supposed to stay. You know, it moves around. It moves, you know, through your skin, through your liver, and then at some point will leave the liver or leave the skin and go someplace else. Well, the way cancer cells do that is they make a particular protein called an enzyme, and that enzyme attacks, cuts up the material between our cells, which normally keep all the cells in place. So it's like taking the mortar out from between the bricks, and then, you know, the bricks don't hold up anymore. So this is kind of the way cancer works. It's one of the most important dastardly techniques that cancer has for progressing. And so what Dr. Bhatia has done is said, well, if we could detect that enzyme, not look for the cell, cancer cells themselves, but look for the sign that the cells are there, but looking for the enzyme, we would be able to amplify the signal and perhaps detect it sooner, because enzymes don't just cut one molecule and go away. They cut and cut and cut. They can cut thousands of molecules with great specificity. So she takes her nanoparticles, decorates them with a little stretch of a protein that the cancer enzyme sees, and at the end of that little stretch of protein, she puts a marker that she can detect. So if in this idea, if you're suspected of having cancer, you are injected with this nanoparticle, these nanoparticles, and they circulate around. And if you don't have cancer, nothing happens to them, and your body gets rid of them the way your body gets rid of lots of stuff. But if you do have cancer, the cancer enzymes will clip those little protein decorations on the nanoparticle, releasing the signal. She's designed the signal to be so small that it finds its way back into the bloodstream. And from the bloodstream, the kidney will filter that signal particle into the urine, where it can be detected. And in her experimental studies, she can detect cancers in experimental animals right now when they are one-tenth the size of current best-in-class detection strategies, which would be amazing. I mean, if we could detect cancer when it's one-tenth the size we can detect today, that would be such a game-changer. And as I said, the company that she started, she's actually started a number of companies using these kinds of technologies called Glimpse Bio, is working on these urine-based disease detection strategies. Now, people say, how could you detect something in urine? I mean, how is that possible? And I just, you know, assert that there is a really great example out there, the urine-based pregnancy test. It's expensive. You buy it over the counter. It's extremely accurate. Right. And early. Yeah. So these are some of the properties that we need for diagnostics. And boy, this COVID pandemic has really demonstrated how far we have still to go on building up our diagnostic muscle, let's just say, our diagnostic capabilities. So
now, and she's working on something now, right, that there's also a lung test that she's been working on that she could also maybe be used for COVID testing?
Well, potentially. She's developed it to be able to discriminate between different kinds of pneumonia. There are different kinds of pneumonia, and each kind has a particular drug that is effective with it. And so you don't want to give drugs that you don't need. You want to be able to understand which kind of pneumonia you have. So she's developed this nanoparticle-based diagnostic as an inhalation diagnostic. Mm. So you would inhale this nanoparticle, similarly decorated with proteins that carry a signal, but the proteins are susceptible to the enzymes of either kind of pneumonia. So each of these kinds of pneumonia, of course, makes enzymes. All cells make enzymes to do their work. And if you have that kind of pneumonia, you inhale the nanoparticle. Those enzymes will be present in your lung. The signaling molecule would get clipped off. And then when you exhale, the signal gets exhaled, which can be analyzed with a breathalyzer kind of a strategy, much as, you know, we use breathalyzers for other things like alcohol levels, for example.
Yeah.
And so one potential use of this kind of breathalyzer diagnostic would be potentially for diseases like COVID, which infect the lungs and have their own set of enzymes. COVID has its own set of enzymes. You potentially detect it that way. But again, so again, it's, you know, potentially low cost, highly accurate, you could produce these diagnostics in very, very great numbers, easy to use, non-invasive. So many, many reasons to think that this could be an important direction forward in amplifying our ability to diagnose critically important diseases like COVID.
It's, yeah, so amazing. So we mentioned that the urine test is in clinical trials now. How long do you anticipate this would be before it would be available to the general public? How long do clinical trials necessarily?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's a while, right?
It's very hard to know, but I have to tell you, I am on the board of Pfizer, so I've had a little bit of an inside view on the development of these vaccines, but the fact that the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccines have been developed over a period of less than a year, process that would normally has normally historically taken about a decade, just kind of changes the game in how we think about being able to make progress on all kinds of diseases. So I don't know. Obviously, all clinical trials are conducted very, very carefully because we want to ensure as best as we can that there aren't unexpected problems with them and unexpected dangers, and also that the tests are as accurate as we would want them to be. So I don't, I can't predict when.
Can't look in your crystal ball.
No, I can't. Yeah. And, this is the other phase, which is this is now, these are companies, real companies. And so not only do you need technology that succeeds, you also need investors who believe that the technology will succeed.
I would think this would have investors. I mean, this is amazing. I'm hoping there are people out there who want to fund that. But as you say, game changer here. I mean, to be able to detect cancer that early is huge.
It would be huge. Just to say that our healthcare system has not been directed toward diagnostics. It's been directed toward treatment and treatment usually at later stage of the disease. So one of the silver linings I'm hoping out of this COVID pandemic is an appreciation for the critical importance of diagnostics. It's critically important for lowering overall healthcare costs in the United States, but it's just not been a focus of our healthcare enterprise up until now.
So since we're mentioning funding here, can you talk about cross-disciplinary efforts and how that impacts funding?
Yeah, Mindy, that's something that I've seen up close and personal. A lot of excitement at MIT and other places for this convergence 2.0, convergence of biology with engineering. Sometimes it's, a person. Sangeeta Bhatia is a trained nanotechnologist and also a trained clinician, so she is convergent in and of herself. But the ideas that she is working on don't fit tidily into the domains that our federal funding agencies for research cover. So I just want to say that our American research enterprise has been world-beating and absolutely extraordinary. It's hard to understand, once you have your cell phone in your hand or once you go to CVS and pick up your prescription, it's hard to appreciate that the technologies that we use today almost all started out from just fundamental research, people just poking around trying to figure out how the world works without intending to produce technologies.
Right.
I make a joke. The electron was discovered in 1897. This is like fairly recent. The electron. And I know that J.J. Thomson, the person who is credited with identifying the electron, did not do that with the idea that I would have a cell phone today. I mean, this wasn't And so he was just curious. And similarly, the people who discovered that DNA is the physical representation of heredity were doing that so that, we would have the kinds of miracle drugs that we have today. That was it took, actually pretty fast, but several decades to get there. So that funding of fundamental research is absolutely critical to get started on this route to progress, all of these technological challenges. Now, we set up, after World War II, an incredible research and development R&D enterprise in the United States, just incredible. Not only did we build the foundations for discovery research, but we also built all of the pieces to change those, move those discoveries into marketplace technologies, economic growth, jobs growth. And the story of the second half of the 20th century in the United States is that story, quite remarkable. However, when we stood up the funding agencies in the United States, each agency has a particular remit. So the National Institutes of Health, a magnificent enterprise, funds clinical work and biological research. The National Science Foundation has, by and large, funded, you know, a lot of the computational and engineering research, some biology. And the Department of Energy has been responsible for funding most of the basic physics research. And, you know, very little overlap by design. So if you have a project that actually crosses those domains, it's very hard to get it funded. Once you've proven something, it may be somewhat easier, but these discipline-crossing activities don't have a home. The National Science Foundation, under the leadership of Franz Cordova, that just passed, director of the National Science Foundation, adopted Convergence 2.0 as one of the main things for the National Science Foundation. But again, she had to move money into it that didn't already exist in an area where she could easily fund these kinds of things. So it's a little bit difficult. But I have to tell you, you know, something else that I feel is just woefully underappreciated relative to the power of what it does is private philanthropy. So the convergence activities that we've stood up at MIT have really, the catalyst for getting them off the ground has been private philanthropy. So individuals who understand that there's great potential in these new kinds of approaches have provided much of the funding to get our convergence activities off the ground. So there are challenges, but right now I think we were beginning to, you know, get a little bit more momentum, and the federal agencies are beginning to look upon these convergence activities with, let's just say, greater enthusiasm for funding them. But getting things started is always hard.
Yeah. You write, we may soon be able to enlist nanoparticles not only to detect and treat cancer, as Sangeeta Bhatia is doing, but also to reverse climate change by capturing carbon dioxide from the air and then turning it into useful industrial and commercial products, such as coating products that can just about coat any surface, self-cleaning and water-repelling. We may soon be able to harness the power of plants to light our homes as well as harvest enough energy from natural sources, for example, the sun, the wind and the tides, to satisfy our energy needs and end our reliance on fossil fuels. But none of this is inevitable. Fostering Convergence 2.0 will require the financial commitment, interdisciplinary collaboration, and political will that made Convergence 1.0 successful. So you talked about some of the challenges, but public support is huge. And I think one of the reasons you mentioned you wrote this book is to kind of help people understand what's happening and some of these amazing discoveries that are happening in the science world. So aside from the challenges you just talked about, the power of public support, maybe.
Yes, absolutely. So I think that, part of the, I always talk about that I grew up under the shadow of Sputnik, except for me, it wasn't a dark shadow. It was a bright beacon of opportunity, hope, and excitement about what science and technology could do for the world. And, you know, the sense of being part of that ambition, part of that national ambition that President Kennedy called out, that we were going to get to the moon and back in 10 years when we had none of the technology.
There
was nothing in, you know, that we knew that was going to get us there. So to invent that whole thing was just quite incredible. And as a national ambition, I'm a huge fan of these large, big ambitions. Obviously, at MIT, we've got an enormous ambition around accelerating progress against cancer. We stood up a big ambition around helping to accelerate the transition to a sustainable energy and bringing people together who by themselves are doing great work, but, you know, bringing them together to get more power from a united effort at an ambition, I think is really important. And, you know, as I said, I grew up under a national ambition, was incredibly motivated by it. My mother found a little illustrated essay I wrote when I was in second grade talking about being a scientist and figuring out how to go to the moon. I mean, even, you know, kids were motivated in this way. And I think it's a piece that, again, you know, I think we need to take on quite consciously and quite deliberately, because, you know, all of us can get caught up in how hard things are. But, you know, many of us can also get caught up in how we can help, you know, turn these difficult times into better times for all. And so I think that's very, very important. You know, obviously individual effort is critical, but individual effort joined together to the common good, I think, is been an incredibly powerful force.
And I love the book, the theme, that it's really about nature's genius to solve our problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very funny. So these tools, I'll tell you another little anecdote. I mean, this is not something I, of course, you know, one of the wonderful things about being part of a university and, frankly, being president of a great university is that you learn so much. It's just, you know, astonishing to be able to sit looking over the frontier of, you know, discovery and innovation is an incredible privilege. But when I arrived at MIT, the then dean of engineering, a magnificent academic leader, Tom Magnanti, was telling me about MIT School of Engineering, which is MIT's largest school with almost 400 faculty. And he told me that a third of those 400 faculty were using biological components in their work. And I, you know, had a sense of what biomedical engineering was because I had worked very hard on a biomedical engineering initiative when I was at Yale. So I said, "You mean biomedical engineering?" And he kind of very, with some condescension, looked at me. He said, "Well, sure, biomedical engineering, but much, much more. People are using these biological parts to do everything." And that really is what the book is about, that we now have a whole set of nuts and bolts, you know, if you would, you know, components. But the components are coming out of biology. So you can use DNA to build things. You can use enzymes as a way to release markers that you can see with higher sensitivity. Biological tools are very small, and so you can get a lot of them into one place, and they're enormously powerful, and it is nature's genius. So when I was visiting the company that builds these biologically-based water filters, the founder of the company told me that he said, you know, I could bust my brain trying to figure out how to build a water filter. Why would I do that? Why don't I just use nature's genius? So nature has already figured out how to filter water with incredible efficiency. We'll just use those tools, you know, rather than building our own. And you know, to me, as a biologist, that stands in awe of nature's extraordinarily clever ways of doing things, that really resonates. So when we look around us at the natural world, or just, you know, frankly, think about what our bodies do, there are so many mysteries that if we solve them, could provide possible new tools to help us address the enormously daunting challenges of the 21st century.
Susan Hockfield, thanks so much for joining us. We will have more information about the book, The Age of Living Machines, How Biology Will Build the Next Technology Revolution, at our website, capeandislands.org. Thanks again.
Thank you, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.